By the time of the Akeda, Avram and Sarah were already in Hebron, looks like as well, for more than 10 years. So the big question then becomes, as Rashi has to explain, so why after the Akeda? So this explains why Sarah died in Hebron, because Sarah was in Hebron. It doesn't explain why after the Akeda, Avram and Yitzchak went back to their Hebron. According to Rashi, they were not living in Beersheba. They were living in Hebron more than 10 years before the Akeda. So Rashi, that's the one question that Rashi does not address. But I see that the Mefarshim say that Avraham and Yitzchak went back to Beersheba because in Beersheba, Avraham did a very special thing when they had lived in Beersheba. That is, it says he planted an eshel. Now, what is eshel? So, again, the translation of eshel is he planted a special tree. But Chazal say eshel is rashi tevis. Achila, eating. Shasia, drinking. And lamed is levoya, doesn't mean funeral, means accompanying people, escorting them when they need tour guides or just company or to be safe and alive. And apparently what Avram did was that although Avram was machnis orchid, wherever he was, and the whole story of the angels is in Hebron, not in Beersheba, but apparently there was a special inn, a special hotel, a special large-scale hachnasas orchid called the Eshel Avram that was in Beersheba. And it's a little strange. I don't really have a picture. If Avram wasn't going to be living in Beersheba, why did he make his biggest thing there? Perhaps because Beersheba is right next to a desert, and that's where wayfarers needed the most hospitality. But it is said that Avraham Avinu wanted to thank Hashem with a larger scale chesed than he was capable of doing in Hebron. Apparently his eshel was staffed. He had his staff were managing it. He came down to the hotel, so to speak. Of course, it was a hotel for free. To give Shabbat Bahoda'a to the Rav. And then he went back. But you see that this is a bit of a delta, because our problem basically is, if they already lived in Hebron, why are they going back to Beersheba? If they lived in Beersheba, why did Sarah die in Hebron? But you're going to have a problem. Avram and Yitzchak go to one place, Sarah dies in another place. Now, other Mishnayim, obviously the opposite. They say, Avram and Yitzchak were living in Beersheba already. Sarah died in Hebron because she went to look for them. They went to Hebron to give thanks to God. She died not where she lived, she died where she was looking for them. That is not Rashi's Shita. Rashi's Shita is that Hebron is where they lived at this point, and Beersheba was simply where Avram and Yitzchak went to give Sheba to Hashem at the Eshel Avram. I believe, I haven't been in Beersheba that many times, but I believe that in Beersheba, they actually have some ancient tree or something that they identify as Avram's tree. Who knows? Nobody knows if that's possible. Trees can live. There are trees that can live thousands of years. There are olive trees that are very, very, very ancient. But we really don't know, especially if Chazal say the Eshel is locked off their tree. It's more like a hotel. Achila, Shasia, and Levoya. Okay, so that's one thing to keep in mind, that it's not so precious to know where Avram Yitzchak lived at various times, but this is Rashi's basic shita. So remember, Elomei Mamre, Hebron, Kiryas Arba are the same place. Okay, then Beersheba was a settlement that was named because of the oath that Abimelech made with Avram, as well as the exchange of seven sheep that was a sign of their covenant. So Sheba is both Shevuah and Shiv. Now another little point I wanted to talk about is that after Sarah dies, and Avram takes another wife, and after he marries Yitzchak, of course, right? So marries off Yitzchak, and Rashi makes the very beautiful point from Chazal that it says that Yitzchak brought her into the tent of Sarah, his mother. she became his wife, and he loved her. And the church points out, very important idea, that the true love that exists between husband and wife is something that comes from the relationship. First they became husband and wife. And then when he saw the kedusha that she brought to the bayis, then he loved. People think that you have to have see stars and you have to hold up for romantic love beforehand. Of course, what does Chazanish once say? What the world calls love, we call chorus. That's what Chazanish once said. But anyway, but the point basically is that the deep love comes from living your life together. And at best, when you get married, you simply have an educated guess that this is the partner of my life. But you really know by living life together. Therefore, real love comes from the marriage. It does not precede the marriage. And in particular, Rashi says, why did he feel such a strong love when he brought her into the tent of Sarah, his mother? Because it says there were three miracles that were connected to the tent, to the home. Sorry, Imenu. One was that when she would light candles in honor of Shabbos, which the elders apparently did, the light would burn the entire week. The other, there was a blessing in even the bread that she made. You ate a little bit of her bread and you were filled for the whole week. And the third, there was a tangible cloud of glory over the home, signifying that this was the makom of the Shechivah. When Sarai Imenu died, all three of those signs appeared. Avram alone, as unbelievably great as Avram was, he could not create that Kedusha, that Sarai. But little Rivka, who according to Chazal and according to Rashi for you, was only 3 years old, when she came into the house, it couldn't have been the very minute, but at least after a week, because some of these are only things you see after a week, but be it as it may, the candle remains burning, the bread had a bracha in it, and a cloud of glory. Yitzchak loved her, not because she was beautiful, although she was. Yitzchak loved her because she was righteous, because she was holy, because she brought the godliness into the home that had been lacking. And that is something that's worthy of you. You love the goodness of a person. Now the Vilna Gaon says, in a very, very interesting thought, the Vilna Gaon says that all love, if it's more than infatuation or sexual desire, all love of human beings is really love of God, because what you truly love love those attributes that represent the godliness within their soul. So this could be even things that you think are not necessarily. So for example, if you love somebody's kindness, because their kindness is a reflection of the kindness of Hashem. You love their wisdom, you love the way they think. That is because of the intellect, that is ultimately a reflection of God. You love their sense of humor. That also God has a sense of humor too, using different ways that you have discovered over the years. And like. So the Vilna Gaon says there is no such thing as true love of a person that is not ultimately love of the godly qualities within a person. And this is why Yitzchak loved Rivka. Yitzchak saw the godliness of these things coming back. And you know, it's interesting, the Ramban says a fascinating point. Ramban says that the three miracles of the Tent of Sarah are the same miracles that later existed in the Mishnah and the Beis HaMikdash after that. The light that lasted from Friday to Friday in the menorah that was lit every day in the Beis HaMikdash, although it had to be refilled and lit every day, but there was one candle that never went out. We talked about the Near Tzimtzum. That candle never went out. Now, the truth of the matter is, there were times when the Jewish people were not righteous, it did go up. So it was not true that it always remained that way. But when the Jewish people were righteous, it remained that way. And then the lechem apanim, the show bread, remained warm and fresh. They put on the gold table on Shabbos, and they didn't eat it till next Shabbos, it was still warm. And the cloud of glory was, of course, over the Mishnah. So the Ramban says the important lesson is that the temple of Judaism, Beis HaMikdash, is a Jewish home, meaning the Mishkan is nothing more than an imitation of the holiness of the Tent of Sora. And the Tent of Sora is a prototype for a Jewish home. So I'm sure you've heard the cliche over the years that they've said in countless rabbinic sermons that the most important institution in Judaism is not the shul, not even the yeshiva. The most important institution of Judaism is the home, the relationship of husband and wife, because in some ways the Beis HaMikdash is just an imitation of the home of Abraham and Sarah. And it's trying to create the home of Abraham and Sarah. So this is the idea of that love. But it's a very interesting thing. Abraham gets remarried after Yitzhak. What's going on? Because again, psychoanalyze here. But think about this. You know, Avram loses Sarah. That's a tragedy. And Avram, of course, is heartbroken. But he's pretty old. He doesn't have to get married again. But and Nebuchadnezzar, when he sees all this kedusha leave, and how does it come back again? His husband drifts into the depths. So Avram thinks, if indeed marrying the right person brings holiness back into the home, then I ought to get married too, to bring that holiness. So in many ways, just looking at the psukim, it appears that the inspiration for Avram to get remarried was seeing the holiness that Rivka brought into the tent of Sarah. And therefore, Avram was jealous, but jealous, God forbid, not in a negative way. But Avram said, I too can recreate this. In Ruchnius, it's okay to be jealous in a positive way. This is the famous statement in the Gemara, Kinas Sofer, the jealousy of Torah scholars increases wisdom. That doesn't mean I'm jealous that I want somebody to fail. Oh, I wish he wouldn't learn so well, just like me. That's not constructive. But to look at somebody and say, if he's doing something good, I can try to do something good. That's legitimate. And I would say, Lanias Daiti, that Abraham was looking at his son and saying the same thing. Look what he accomplished. Because Abraham was sort of got him his way through the Ezra. Look at what he accomplished. I can do it too. I am so old. I'm 137 because Abraham is 10 years older than Sarah. The answer is, you're never too old to do mitzvahs, whatever the mitzvah is. I remember reading the Moshe Feinstein. I don't know if you heard of it. Years, more than that already. He was a very, very humble person. But I don't tell you this for a second. I had one mice with him, myself, when I was 9 years old. But anyway, I just want to finish this story first. So the last few years of his life, though, he was very, very frail. Very, very frail. That's why, by the way, I think Rebbe Yashub gets a bad rap, because you'll often hear the following. You'll hear the following idea. They'll say, Rebbe Yashub was towards the end of his life, he only saw people like an hour a day, he refused to see people more than that. But Rebbe Moshe Feinstein was seeing people, the door was always open, he only saw hundreds and hundreds of people. But in a way, it's an apples and oranges comparison. And the reason is, Rebbe Moshe Feinstein was nifter at around 91. So Rebbe Yashub was nifter at 104. And the MS is, when Rav Moshe already was 90, he was not seeing people the last year or two. So you can't really compare. Now, although it may sound to you, being a young person, hey, what's the difference? 25-year-old, 30-year-old, not a big difference. believe me, although I don't know myself yet, that 95 and 104 is a very big difference. It's not the same as 20 and 30. So as a result, Rav Yashu was actually doing superhuman. And the fact that he was able not only to learn all day, but to see all the people that he did see
even if it was a small window of time, was really superhuman. You cannot compare it to Gedolin, who saw more people, but they were younger. They were literally 10 years or 15 years younger than Rabbi Yashar. So it's a very, people sometimes say it, it's a very, very unfair accusation if you really understood the situation. Okay. But be it as it may, with Rav Moshe Feinstein, the very last Shabbos of his life, he didn't know this was the last Shabbos of his life, they were making minyanim in his house. And they couldn't get a minyan because there was a big ufraf, and like everybody went to the ufraf. So they told Rav Moshe, you know, maybe we have to talk to Muslim Yechidus. Now his son's like, we don't have a minyan. So Rav Moshe said, could you try to get a minyan? So I don't know who they found, but they, you know, they went around the whole Lower East Side, and they managed to get people who didn't double disappear. So when he was eating his last Shabbos soup with his children, who themselves are great Rosh Yeshivas, David and Reuben, he took their hand and said, remember, remember, you have to grab mitzvahs whenever you can. Never say you're too old, never say you're too sick. Look for an opportunity to do the mitzvah. So did you want to say something?
When he was to Abraham, he was looking at Yitzchak, and he saw that Rivka was bringing back the Shekhinah. So what more did you want to add? He was jealous, of course, of the Kedusha that he brought back, so what more Kedusha did you want to
add? But the answer is Yitzchak was making his own home. In other words, Yitzchak is a married man, right? So Abraham wants to have his bias too. In other words, you don't just live through your children. That's also an important lesson. Sometimes, you know, we tend to live through our children. Ah, my child's a wonderful person. He learns, he does Torah, you know, etc. Abraham says, no, I still have to be a tzaddik also. I have to grow also. I can't just say, my kids are taking over. So I think that's a good answer for a parent too. You don't simply say, oh, my child learns, etc. Professor Rebbe used to say, everybody does everything for their child. He wants to meet that last child in history that everyone's doing everything for. I work so my child will learn. And then my child grows up, he'll do it for his child. So who's that last child that everybody is doing everything for? Okay. I remember years ago, I was once attending a Vada Chinuch, Board of Education meeting for a religious school. And the parents were discussing what extra learning they could add to the school day so the kids would learn more. Mishmar, different things. These are like elementary school. So, you know, the kids had a pretty long school day already. Now, they weren't in from modern Orthodox home, so it's not like the Haredi day they were learning for a long day, whatever. And I knew, maybe I shouldn't know, but I knew what a lot of the parents were doing at night, and it was not necessarily learning. But they're trying to think about all the ways they can inspire their kids to learn. So I thought, I didn't say it, I thought to myself, you want to inspire your kids to learn. You don't tell them, learn more. You learn more. When you learn more, that inspires them. Do as I say, not as I do, is not a good recipe for chinuch. The greatest chinuch is when children see what the parents are passionate about. Same thing with Avram. Avram doesn't simply say, oh, Yitzchak, you be a kid. Avram still works with us. So, therefore, Avram takes another wife. The wife is Keturah. But now Rashi tells us, you don't know this from the Chumash itself. Rashi tells us, actually, Keturah is hardly a stranger. Keturah is none other than the wife that he kicked out a few years before at Sarah's own instigation, because she was a bad, not she, but Yishmael was a bad influence. And Yishmael is now grown up and doing his own thing. He takes Keturah back, and she is now a righteous woman. Na'eh Keturah. Na'eh Ma'aseha Kiktores. Her deeds are as pleasant as the beautiful fragrance of incense. In fact, Rashi learns, even Yishmael Yishmael leaves the world with everything, all the loose ends, tied up neatly. He comes back, Hagar gets reunited, Yishmael does tshuva, although that didn't last, at least at this point in Avram's life. Even Esav. Now Esav was actually already born when Avram died. Esav did not become a public Russian until the day Avram died. As long as Avram was born, even Esav was righteous. So Avram really had this great completion of seeing all these good things. And from Keturah, Avram had children. One, two, three, Zimran, Yokshan, Dan, Sri, Midjan, and some of these are nations you know it. The Midjanites, right? Later. Yashba, Shuach, etc. So we have really a number of nations that are called B'nai Keturah. So it's very interesting. The Gemara in Sanhedrin says the following statement. Although the mitzvah of Milah was given to Avraham, and the children of Yishmael, this is a very common misconception, Yishmael circumcised. Yishmael had a bris when he was 13. But Yishmael's children do not have that bris. That was a one-time Yishmael. Although the B'nai Yishmael are not chayiv in the circumcision, Muslims do it, but they are not chayiv in circumcision, B'nai Keturah are chayiv. Descendants of Keturah do have to circumcise. Now, there's a big machlok, this is Gemara in Sanhedrin. There's a big machlok as Rashi and the Rambam, what that means. What does it mean, B'nai Keturah are chayav in Bris Milah? According to the Rambam, it just means these specific children. Now, according to the according to Rashi, it just means these specific children. So, according to Rashi, it's exactly symmetrical to Yishmael, because essentially what it means is, Yishmael was born from Avram. He has to have a bris. These kids were born to Avram from Keturah. They have to have a bris. But it doesn't go forward to the new generation. The only way it goes forward is via Yitzchak and then via Yaakov. So according to Rashi's understanding of the Gemara, B'nai Keturah, in other words, basically all of Hagar's children are the same. Yishmael is Hagar's son when she was called Hagar, and these are her children when she's called Keturah. It's all the same. First generation gets a bris, after that, no one. This is Rashi, and in a way, it's very logical, because it's very difficult to see why would I treat the descendants of Keturah more than the descendants of Yishmael. According to Rashi, they're treated the same. The Rambam, however, has a very different interpretation. According to the Rambam, the B'nai Keturah were commanded to engage in Bris Milah in perpetuity. Although Yishmael, it's only Yishmael and not B'nai Yishmael, but the descendants of Keturah have to have a bris. And then the Rambam gives you another halacha. And he says, since over time the descendants of Yishmael intermarry with the descendants of Keturah, and therefore when you meet an Arab, or an Arab himself doesn't know, is he descended from Keturah or from Yishmael, all Arabs are obligated in circumcision, but not because people think they're descended from Yishmael. If they knew they were descended from Yishmael, they would not be chayav in circumcision. But rather, there's a chashash, they might be descended from Keturah. So bottom line is that the Arabs, according to halacha, I don't mean Islam, the Arabs, according to halacha, are obligated to circumcise, according to the Rambam's view, but not because of their descent from Yishmael, but because of their descent from Keturah, in which there's an intermarriage between Keturah, between B'nai Keturah, because all of them were Bedouins. All of these nations were wandering nations, and obviously they intermarried. So,
Don't you say that the Brit Mila is personal thing we can ask in Hashem? How come you have another nation that's obligated in the same way?
Yes, it is a good kasha, but there is a concept that a bris is a covenant, of course, a covenant. But a covenant can exist on several levels, and basically the descendants of Avram all have a covenantal relationship with God. The Jewish people have a deeper covenant. Now, the question you could ask is, well, wait a second. If you're going to simply say all descendants of Abraham have a covenant, so why do you differentiate between Yishmael and Keturah, especially since Keturah is Hagar? In other words, what I just said isn't totally true, because with Yishmael, we don't have a covenant that continues. So you have to say like this. You have to say that all of the children of Abraham that are born after the covenant that Hashem made with them, after Abraham's rest, all of them are within the covenant. Yishmael was born beforehand, so his descendants are not in the covenant. But I would say this, again, it's an amazing thing. It's a difficult thing to understand. But that does mean Hashem has a certain, according to the Rambam, not according to Rashi. According to the Rambam, Hashem has a certain level of a covenantal relationship with B'nai Keturah. And in fact, the Svarim HaKadoshim tell us, this is why, in the period before Mashiach, the most dangerous adversary we ever face are the Arabs. Because every other adversary has material power, political power, wealth, weapons. Yishmael has that too. But all the other nations don't have spiritual power. The Arabs have what you might call dark, negative spiritual energy, just like there's matter and antimatter. And there's a certain koach they get, which is a destructive koach. It's not a positive condition. But it's like the nuclear energies, right? The energy can be used for power plants, it can be used for antibodies. They have a spiritual power. And according to the Rambam, that spiritual power comes from these people. Some level of power they have with God. That is why they are exceptionally dangerous. They are dangerous because if it's just Ruchnius against Gashmius, Ruchnius will ultimately triumph. But when it's Ruchnius against the spiritual force, that's going to be much more difficult.
Is it true that spiritual nations actually are male.
Yeah. So this is this. Now, that's a very good. Yeah, I was going to bring that up because, so according to the Rambam, the B'nai Keturah that were sent away, they simply hung around the desert and they interbreeded with B'nai Yishmael, and that's why the B'nai Keturah needs circumcision. But there is another tradition in the Medrash, which is not like the Rambam says, that when it says that B'nai Keturah were sent east, that doesn't just mean east into the desert. But east means real east. That is, they found their way to China, India, Thailand, all those places. And it is said that the source of the wisdom of the east, which later got intermeshed with Avodah Zarah, like Buddhism and the like, that there is a core of spiritual truth in those religions. Are the gifts that Abraham says he gave them gifts and he sent them away? The gifts that he gave them were that which became the wisdom of the East. And that could very well be why, it's unfortunately so, but it is undoubtedly the case, that Jews are disproportionately attracted to Buddhism. Jews love Buddhism. If you're not good, you'll be a Buddhist. Because basically that's true. 90% of English-speaking converts to Buddhism are Jews. 90%, 9 out of 10. How could that be? On one hand, it's a very, very sad thing. Buddhism is probably idolatrous and the like. But on the other hand, there's something very good about it in the following way. Buddhism, and I'm not going to give a whole share of Buddhism, but Buddhism is a religion that is very non-materialistic, which focuses on simplicity, it focuses on spirituality, it focuses on equanimity, meaning accepting what happens in life without complaint, without bitterness. And since every Jewish soul seeks a connection to God, if they don't know that Yiddishkeit is giving it, they don't know what Judaism is. So they'll look for anything. In other words, what I'm saying is that a Jew becomes a Buddhist is a spiritual seeker. It's not a religion of materialism. He's seeking spirituality. But Nebuch, the perversion is that they grow up with a Judaism that is materialistic, that focuses on money. So they think, I want to be spiritual. I don't want to be Jewish. What does Judaism have to do with spirituality? I don't remember the high holiday tickets. If you're not, you don't have your ticket, you can't go into the service. I don't know if you ever counted. I think today, in recent years, almost every Sunday guys will become more modern. But I remember as a kid, if you went to the bathroom, you had to show your ticket to get back into the show. Where's your ticket? You have these big ushers. Where's your ticket? There's blue for a kid, yellow for an adult, the different thing. You have to show your ticket to get in. Right? So people grow up and they see this, people only care about money. So what I'm saying is, the very thing that is so safe, that Jews are turning to Buddhism, is actually the reason to be very hopeful. The Jewish neshama is looking for witness, looking for a connection to God, and if they could see that Judaism has that, then Baruch Hashem, they can become the best Jews, the most devoted Jews, the Jews that are passionate, the Jews that are so connected to us, because that's what they're looking for. So you have to respect somebody who is a sinner, even if they're going in the wrong direction. Because at least they're looking. Sometimes you can have a person who is like born from, who's been from all of his life. But he's not looking. Stagnant. Not moving. Somebody who moves is alive, even if they're moving in bad ways. If you show them the right way, they'll grab onto it. So you're 100% correct that the reference here to sending him to the East might be a reference to the truths that are found in Eastern religion that then got intermeshed with paganism and what I thought, that there's a core of emes to them. So, we Jews claim everything. We claim the Western religions. Christianity and Islam, came from us. That's for sure. And now we even claim the Eastern religion. There are still. Abraham is responsible for everything. All ideas about God in the world come from Abraham Avinu. Even though over the years it gets perverted and mixed up with all sorts of other doctrines. Okay, so this is deep in the
What is the mosque of the world?
Oh, yes, thank you. I do want to tell you this because for this very day, it happened, I don't want to say how many years ago, but it happened when I was 9 years old, a long time ago. The thing is that I grew up in Hartford, Connecticut. Matthew is West Hartford, but I'm from the old neighborhood, Hartford, Connecticut. And Rav Moshe Feinstein used to take a 2-week vacation every year. And he wanted to go to a place where nobody would ask him any shaylos. So he identified all over the world where would be a place that nobody would bother him. He figured Hartford, Connecticut. Now, the reason he went to Hartford also because he had a relative in Hartford that he trusted, because he and everything else. So I was in fourth grade. And I would go there, I would daven in a shul and then walk to school, before school. So I was over to be in the car that would take him to shul that we wanted. And a lot of the things that I remember, I read later in biographies, I was transfixed because I didn't know Yiddish at all. He spoke in Yiddish, but I was transfixed. But I clearly remember like a shining light coming off his face. I remember staring at his face a lot. And I also remember, it was fascinating to me, that between Aliyahs, he had this Mishnayos that he would learn. And I had never seen anyone, he learns between the Aliyahs, the Torah reading, and the like. And even when he was wrapping up his tefillin, I literally never had seen this before. So anyway, one day, we pick him up, we show, etc., and it was raining that day. Everybody went home. I was still going home or something. And around 10 minutes later, there's a knock at the door. And the driver comes in and says, Rabbi Feinstein said, he remembered you were in the car with us, and now he sees it's raining, so he asked me to take you to school. He didn't want you to walk in the rain. Now, the truth of the matter is, nobody else cared about that. In particular, I didn't care. It was no big deal. The school was 2 blocks away. And here you have the Gadol Hador, the greatest rabbi of the generation, who didn't want a 9-year-old kid to walk home, to walk to school, to walk 2 blocks in the rain. And he asked the driver to come back. So to me, this is like a permanent. Really, it's very much. I was going to send this to Artsville when they put out promotional articles. So maybe I'll get a story in it. I didn't submit it on time or something. But anyway, but the thing is, to me, this is a real memory. Because we could talk about Rav Moshe's new shots by the new Shulchan Aruch. He could ask him any Shiloh, the most typical Shilohs in the world. And that same person never wasted a second. He was a brilliant genius. Who was the Posei Kador. But there was no one that was too unimportant for him to care about. And that's really the measure. To a great person, there is nothing that is small. We sometimes think, oh, I do important things. I'm not going to bother with unimportant. To a Gadol, there is nothing that is unimportant. There is no person that is unimportant. And to this day, when I think of what is a Gadol, that is what I think about. That is what I think about.
Can you explain, sir?
Big, 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 big,